Welcome to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, where we discuss the big topics facing our food, the countryside and animal welfare. My guest today is TV presenter, photographer, conservationist and one of Britain's best-loved naturalists, Chris Packham. Best known for fronting The Really Wild Show, BBC Spring Watch and Autumn Watch, Chris is also a champion for wildlife, leading calls for much stronger protection. Chris, thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure.
Chris, like you, I've been a wildlife enthusiast since I was a small boy. In fact, for me, it happened when I was about seven, when I was off school with chicken pox. And my mum was tearing her hair out, wondering how to entertain this sickly kid for weeks on end. And she gave me the Observer Book of Birds. And I was hooked. I suddenly saw things out of the window that I'd never seen before. I know that you've been hooked on wildlife since a small boy too, reading your recent book, Fingers in a Sparkle Jar, where you describe those early forays with nature, how you wanted a kestrel, a bat and an otter, how you wanted to know how tadpoles tasted, and how you soaked up knowledge like a sponge. You wrote, wasps drank, newts gulped, skaters skidded, everything was new, everything needed knowing. That was you in those early days. Chris, what sparked that fascination? And do you still feel it?
I still feel it. I felt it this morning when I was out with Scratchy. We'd been out for a walk in the woods. And, you know, the colours, the shape, the textures, the form, the smell of that place is uplifting every single day. It's the most important part of my day when I'm here at home is going into that known space where I feel very comfortable with Scratchy, who I love very much. He's my greatest companion. So the two of us being alone together there is intensely rewarding, both in terms of our physical health, because we have a nice walk, our mental health, because it's that calming, closed, comforting, anxiety-free environment. And also because, well, certainly from my point of view, I'm stimulated by my surroundings. There's still so much to learn. There's still so much out there that needs knowing, you know, things. And at this time of year, it's fungi. I found a species of fungi this morning. I photographed it. I haven't looked it up yet, but I'll try and pursue an identification a bit later. It wasn't just about identifying it. I'm not just, it's for me, it's not just about putting names on things, it's about knowing them. So along with Scratchy, I was down at ground level having a good sniff and feeling the texture of it. It's got an extraordinary texture, looking at the various flies and gnats that were on it, no doubt laying their eggs into it as well, checking out, you know, its growth form. All of that is part of that enriching experience. And how it started, I think it was an early appreciation of the simple beauty of life. And it was nothing more complex than having a ladybird on the tip of my finger or those tadpoles in the palm of my hand. You know, it was those simple things which are undeniably and completely beautiful, which in suburban Southampton at some stage in the early 60s, you know, ignited that spark which still burns today, basically.
In your book again, Fingers in the Sparkle Jar, you talk about being around your suburban home in 1973 when you must have been early teens, if that, and you talk about how, you know, essentially there is no instant gratification with wildlife. That, and this is what you wrote: fidgeting was impossible. I had to remain immobile and barely breathing. I had to remain dead still, coiled like a lizard amongst camouflage of leaves. A beetle trundled over my sleeve. Ants zigzagged, trickles over my legs, and a grasshopper scraped a song beside my cheek, until finally the thrushes heralded dusk. My anticipation abolished pain. The whole world shrank into this one small stage, and all that existed was my immense excitement and arthritic focus. and nothing happened.
That's what happens, isn't it? How many times have we sat waiting for something which we have an enormous craving for? You know, sometimes I convince myself that it's my destiny to see something at that point in time. Therefore, it must happen, but it doesn't happen. And I think the doesn't happen is something which, for me, has always fueled the desire. You know, if everything was easy, if wildlife came off the shelf, if those life-changing experiences were bookable or payable, they'd be valueless. You know, when people often say, you know, what's your greatest wildlife encounter? They're none that I've orchestrated. They're all things that have taken me entirely by surprise. Very often, you know, close to home or in my garden, you know, never things in exotic places. You can spend a lot of time, effort, energy and money traveling to a far-flung part of the planet and you can see the beast, meet the plant. But, you know, sometimes when something like a sparrowhawk just flicks through the garden and you catch that momentary unplanned glimpse that leaves you wanting more, it's that that tattoos a memory far more indelibly in the mind than some postcard that you've collected somewhere else. And it's that sort of engagement that I find most titillating. I think you're right to wonder how current generations feel about that, because they do live in a different world. They live in a world where everything is instantaneous. They will say, you know, do we need knowledge because we have information at our fingertips? They can get onto Wikipedia. I argue that knowledge actually provides context. Information is just, you know, facts, basically disconnected facts. But anyway, the instantaneous rewards that they get mean that it might be more difficult for them to engage. I know for a fact that my stepdaughter has pursued a keen interest in photography because as soon as she presses the button, she sees the image on the back of the camera. I don't think her disposition would have seen through a developing interest in photography had she needed to wait for 2 weeks for a tiny box of slides to rattle through the letterbox. So it's a different world. But I still think that there are, you know, enough young people out there who are, you know, excited and have their lives enlivened by wildlife. But it's the wider group that we need to embrace. We need to get a broader respect for life growing in young people. And I think there are probably other avenues that we need to explore. And food is one of them. There's no doubt about that. Most young people have no idea where their food comes from at all. And we hear these horror stories about them thinking that chickens only lay one egg a year and cows only produce one pint every 3 months. I don't know. But the one thing's for sure, I think, you know, if we were to get young people into contact with food, that would be a route to nature and the environment. Then they would have to have a better understanding of nature and the environment, because effectively that's what supports our food growing processes.
Absolutely. And I think that's what worries me is that, you know, we have had this disconnect with our food and the fact that without a decent environment, there is no farming, there is no food. It's often pitted as one or the other. Do you want, you know, an efficient food system, a thriving farming community, or do you want an environment, you know, a countryside? Which do you choose? Well, actually, that's a false choice.
Of course it is. We had a healthy farmed environment for thousands of years. It was diverse. It you know, actually generated a mosaic of habitats that weren't there before we farmed that environment. But those days we farmed in sympathy and harmony with nature. Now it's all about dominating nature. It's about controlling it, and generally controlling it without tolerance. It's about pesticides. It's about herbicides. But what we're doing is damaging that environment beyond the point that it will support our farming processes. You know, we know that soils are in a disastrous state, not just in the UK, but all over the world. You know, soil's fundamental to any farming, any terrestrial farming. You know, if we don't look after those soils, we are doomed. And we have the knowledge. This is perhaps the most frustrating thing of this rather strange age that we live in. We live in an age where You know, our ability to understand the processes of the natural world have never been greater due to advancements in technology and the accumulation of knowledge that's been put together over hundreds, tens and of years. But also, paradoxically, we're living at a time when most of it's gone and it's going. And we're very conscious of that, too. But what makes me set my alarm clock earlier and earlier and earlier is the frustration that we have the answers to solve the problems, but we're just not doing it.
That's a really interesting point. And I think you and I and an army of amateur naturalists and what have you have gotten out of bed early in the morning to go and do their surveys for the British Trust for Ornithology. I do bird ringing in the reed bed local to here at Farlington Marshes. You know, we know down to a very finite degree the plight of species and what's happening. And what's your analysis of the state of the countryside? And why isn't more being done given how we've really pinned it down that there seems to be a downward spiral?
Well, I think we live in quite an unusual country to start with. Things are very different on continental Europe. We live in a country where more land is owned by less people than any other country in the world. And that means that the land-owning fraternity is a very powerful one, and they've been making most of the choices. And since land is money in the UK, farming has gravitated to maximising profit. It's all about profit. And as a consequence, small farms have struggled, large farms have prospered. Those large farms are, I think, largely controlled by very powerful, international lobbyists and companies. You know, we're talking about agrochemical companies who are, deeply ingrained as lobbyists in the UK government. They hold way too much sway. And unfortunately, I think what's happening at the moment, there's a bit of a backlash taking place where we've realised Nature Report 2016 said quite clearly that one, if not the most important drivers of decline in the UK environment is industrial agriculture. And this is leading to a bit of a backlash where people are blaming farmers. Well, there are certainly some bad farms out there, but there are some very good farmers too. And I think at this point, it's clear that we've got to see the difference between those things and support as rapidly and as effectively as possible those farmers who do understand the problems. They're interested in securing a sustainable future for them, their business as well. And they see that sustainability as embracing a care for wildlife and the environment. They've seen that necessity. So we have to be encouraging of them. But I do think that at the same time, we have to push back much harder against those people who are damaging the environment. And when we know that, they resisted the banning of neonics, we've had people within our own government so efficiently lobbied by the fraternities that were peddling these poisons that they refused, to try and get them banned and they refused to undertake the moratorium that existed in Europe for a while. Well, that's not good. That's not good at all. Now we've got the same issues with glyphosate. Whenever I raise my voice against it, I get an enormous barrage of abuse from people who are wedded to this idea that we should be entirely dependent on these very, very dangerous cocktails of chemicals. But I know I can get in my car and I can drive a short distance to a farm, which is like a piece of heaven. You know, it's got beautiful hedgerows. It's got an enormous biodiversity. It's organic and it turns a profit, So there are healthy farmed environments to be had. But at the same time, I think there are some greedy people out there that don't want them to happen. And that's the bottom line. So, yeah, we've got to pick a fight, but with the right people. And it's not all farmers. Farmers are not bad people. Some of the things that some farmers do are very bad. There's a clear difference.
I think you're absolutely right in that it's not about farmers, it's about industrial farming, the practice, industrial agriculture. And you were very kind enough to give a quote for my most recent book, Dead Zone, Where the Wild Things Were, which which
important books, both of them.
Well, thank you. And it was very much about trying to drive home the message that industrial agriculture is not only an issue of farm animal cruelty, but also is a major driver of wildlife declines. And in there, I meet many farmers who are doing some fantastic things, using mixed rotational farming systems. Without the chemicals. A chap near us in Basingstoke, Tim May, he used to put 9 different chemical applications on each of his harvests. And what he noticed, to your point about soils earlier, is that his yields were decreasing because his soils were shot. They were tired and they were eroding. So what he decided to do was to move away from what had been essentially a chemical-driven monoculture on a very big farm, 10 times the UK average-sized farm. He restored farm animals, first cattle and then sheep, on a mixed rotational pasture-based system, left the chemicals in the barn, and now wildlife is flooding back. He has the Wildlife Trust monitoring what's happening, and it's a real success story. And how do you feel about Brexit, for example? Is that an opportunity to reclaim the countryside, to move beyond industrial agriculture? What do you see of this sort of once-in-a-lifetime change, whether we voted for it or not?
Yeah.
And I personally did not vote for it. What do you see as the prospect over these coming
years?
Well,
I'm intensely worried to start with, obviously. Yeah, I am worried, yeah. I think that we are going to have to, you know, work very, very hard to get legislation in place that matches the current European legislation. And we're going to have to work very, very, very hard to improve it. But you're right, of course, it's an opportunity to improve it. And we know that, for instance, the Habitats Directive, the Birds Directive and all these sorts of things have had a profoundly important role in protecting the UK landscape and the species that live there. And European funding, Life Project and others, have put large amounts of cash into the hands of effective conservationists in the UK. So we are going to lose all of that. The NGOs will lose their grants. People like the RSPB, will lose access to millions of pounds. And the RSPB are quite good at turning millions of pounds into good quality conservation. So all of these things are a worry. The Common Agricultural Policy has been, short of reform, I think, for some considerable time. I mean, we've voted for governments who have consistently said that they would, lobby for reform of the CAP, which hasn't helped farming in the UK, for sure. So there is an opportunity, since we won't be under the, auspices of the CAP, to do our own thing. But again, I worry at the power of the lobbyist and the landowning fraternity to carry on doing what they're doing. It comes down to one fundamental thing. Pessimism is present in my psyche because I've learned that human beings don't like changing their mind. That's the problem. Mm. And we come up with new science, we come up with new ideas, we come up with new proven methods, and people still won't change their mind. You show them a better course and they still won't take it. We've got this strange mental quirk that it takes years or catastrophes to get us to change our mind. And I've seen it so many times, we both have, in many aspects of human life, that when things go critically, badly and dangerously wrong, all of a sudden we wake up and make changes. We're good at cure, we're not very good at prevention. And that's a great sadness because it's an indictment of our failings. When you think of how intelligent as a species, how adaptable as a species we are, that we still have to trip over before we see a stick on the ground, it just bemuses me and saddens me. But yeah, look, we're going to rally together, all of the NGOs, everyone who wants to raise a voice, and through this uncomfortable, difficult process of Brexit, we are going to try and come out the other side with the opportunity to sculpt a better, healthier, more sustainable UK landscape where we can have animals and habitats being properly looked after in the farm environment, and wildlife prospering too. I mean, that has to be our ambition. We must never, I mean, you've always got to aim for the stars to get to the sky. On this occasion, I think we've got to aim for the outer galaxies to get to Alpha Centauri, because, you know, our wildlife, our landscape is in desperate trouble. So yes, we've got to do it. I just wish that we were as strategically thinking, as well funded, and as effective as the people that we're going to need to push back against, basically.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
And that's why one of the things I think that the conservation movement needs to do is to unite. You know, we all have our disparate interest, and we're sometimes very good at doing, you know, good things for conservation, but in a narrow way. And I think if all of us would get together and bang our heads together and see the bigger picture, and that is that there is, in fact, a complex connectivity between all of these things, whether you're rehabilitating hedgehogs, whether you're opposed to fox hunting, whether you're campaigning to, you know, have the verges mown after they've finished flowering, whether you're sick of them cutting Sheffield Street trees down, these are actually all related. And they're related because they come from a passionate care for the world, the natural world around us. And if we engender enough respect to not cut the verges, then that will spill into, you know, putting an end to, you know, a savage practice of tearing foxes to pieces with dogs. It's about engendering, you know, and recognising a commonality in our purpose. And that is that we want a healthier landscape and a greater respect for the things that live in it. You know, I spend most of my time working in a wildlife hospital, looking after pigeons and hedgehogs. What's that got to do with, you know, the quality of the food that we eat? Well, the point is, you're looking after hedgehogs that have declined by 97% since the 1950s, because the environment where your food comes from is in a parlous state. There's a pretty direct link between the two. You know, and it's getting people to look outside the hedgehog box and see that bigger picture, and then thinking that they've actually got to be proactively trying to make a difference, not just for hedgehogs, but for the entire environment. And that is food. That's everything. Why is it, for instance, that the way that we treat and respect our dogs in this country, our cats in this country, our companion animals, our rabbits, whatever they happen to be, is different than an animal which is just over the fence in a farm? Well, there's such an artificial construct. What's that about? Why is it that if I did what people do to those farm animals, to my pet, I'd be on the front page of the Daily Mail, pilloried as a, you know, as someone who was exacting enormous cruelty? You know, what, that's such a bizarre idea. You know, the quality of it, they're both domestic animals. I mean, dogs were domesticated, you know, probably 17,000 to 30,000 years ago, parallel with sheep and goats and cattle and cats about 9,000 years ago. We've been living alongside all of these animals for that time. But just because some of them, you know, are what we call meat, okay, then that means that we apparently think it's okay to treat them completely differently. See, for me, it's difficult to compute that. But what we need to get is to other people to ask that question of themselves, and then to think, yeah, do you know what? I can't compute that either. I've got to change that. We've got to change that. We've got to engender, you know, a similar respect for all life. And for me, that's tremendously important. And I think that another thing that we've got to do is that we've got to respond. We've got to campaign more fervently, and we've got to respond to that campaigning, you know, because all too often we like to comfort ourselves with small successes, and we use them as a veil to hide the larger scale problems on the other side, and we don't face up to them. You know, that's the issue. I mean, they say that 86% of the people in the UK are opposed to fox hunting, but that 86% of the populace aren't campaigning to end it. Why not? If they don't like it, if they are opposed to it, if they see it as barbaric, outdated, unnecessary, cruel, why aren't they, you know, why is it only 1% of us are trying to put an end to it? So it's about people needing to be more motivated, because they see a connection between, you know, fox hunting and the wider environment, that part of the environment which does impact upon them, you know.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And what we try to do at Compassionate Rural Farming is give people a platform, give people a route in to being mobilised to help us ban battery cages or veal crates or whatever the latest horrendous farming method is. What we're also trying to do increasingly now is to show people how the dots join up. To your point, how things are interconnected, how keeping animals in cages, crates and confinement actually causes damage and wipes away a lot of our wildlife, how it also means that animals have to be fed antibiotics to keep them alive, which is why half the world's antibiotics are fed to farm animals, leading to disease resistance. Antibiotic resistance in these superbugs, and so on and so forth. And what we've also been doing, a couple of new things for us. One is trying to bridge the gap between animal welfare and conservation, hence our conference last year that you and I talked about, the Extinction and Livestock Conference in London, where we brought together WWF and BirdLife International and a whole host of partners from the animal welfare community, from the conservation community, to start to see that bigger picture, to start focusing on a bigger future. And we're also now taking this to the UN, looking to get a United Nations agreement akin to the Paris climate change deal, but on food and farming, on the tenet that climate change will seriously affect the future of our children and our children's children. Industrial agriculture feeds into that climate change scenario. It fuels greenhouse gases and what have you. It is also, picking up on a couple of your earlier themes, also is what's causing declines in our wildlife, in the bees that are needed for so much of our food, and in the soils. The UN prediction is that we have 60 harvests left in the world's soils, which is the working title for my next book. Spoiler alert there. It is a serious scenario, and far too many politicians, people in power, have their heads in the sand. How, given all of that adversity, how do you stay hopeful? What is it that gives you hope?
I think because I trust science, and I trust that we are rapidly uncovering solutions to many of these problems. We are aware of the problems. That's the first thing. I mean, you can't solve anything if you're not aware of it. We are aware of the problems, the 60 harvest. You know, these things are being calculated. They're being measured. And increasingly, due to our intelligence and adaptability, we're coming up with solutions. But that's where the ball stops. That's where it doesn't make progress, because after that we're not implementing the solutions. You know, I know full well, given the resources, I could start this afternoon, you know, given, you know, if I was king for a day, that sort of scenario, I could start this afternoon, I could make a difference for wildlife by this evening, you know, because there are a whole raft of things that I could do instantaneously, but they're not being done. Why aren't they being done? I don't think we're yet in a position to elect decision makers who are particularly educated in looking after biodiversity. Now, let's think, 25 years ago, most of our politicians across the UK and Europe would not have been terribly aware of climate change. One or two, perhaps, 25, 30 years ago. Now, they all are, and they all have to be. It's part of their job description, basically. And bearing in mind that the vast majority of them are not scientists, so this is something that they've had to generate an awareness of and some degree of expertise in. Same thing hasn't happened with biodiversity. You know, these people, they don't understand fundamentals of ecology. Some of them, I fear, haven't got past the Ladybird Book of Ecology, or in fact, page one of it. And so my hope is that at the moment, the triage that we're applying, the sticking plasters that we're putting on as rapidly and as effectively as we possibly can, will keep, you know, nature alive, enough of nature alive, up until the point that we have new generations of decision makers who do understand, and they will make the right decisions because they know they need to. And again, you know, things are fixable. It'd be much better not to have to mend them. It would be better to keep them healthy in the first place. And that's what we're trying to do, piecemeal at the moment. But we've got to gravitate as rapidly as possible towards better educated, better informed decision makers. And one of my, you know, idealistic, you know, ambitions, if you like, would be to take wildlife and environmental care out of politics, you know, out of party politics and terms of government. I think, you know, it doesn't work in terms of government, whether they're 5, 7 or whatever period they are. Much of environmental care needs significant long-term investment, and decisions that are made in one term of government won't actually produce, you know, positively or negatively until perhaps 3 or 4 governments' time. So I think we need to take it outside of that. It needs to be independent. That would be ideal. So that when it came to energy planning, I mean, I don't even know if we've got an energy plan in the UK. To be quite honest with you, it seems to be entirely random. And it changes every 5 years when we get a new government. But you can't do that. How can you plan an energy plan for a nation like ours that's only going to be, you know, in progress for 5 years? It's nonsense, absolute nonsense. So we need to take these sorts of environmental impacting, farming, energy, all of these really should be outside of party politics in terms of government. They need longer term, secure, you know, high level investment. They need to be, you know, organised and run by people who are scientists and ecologists, people who fundamentally understand what they're doing. And they need to be, you know, have the public support and public trust. And at the moment, I think public trust in politics in general is hopefully at its lowest ebb. Because, like I say, sometimes we have to get to rock bottom before we start coming back up. But we've gone through in the UK, when you think scandal after scandal after scandal, where our politicians have let themselves down and therefore let us down. And that's engendered a mistrust in the young population, who frankly didn't bother to vote for, you know, in Brexit. They were so disenfranchised, they don't think voting means anything, which is a very sad situation. And then you've got global politics, where things are, appalling, absolutely appalling. Particularly in some of the larger nations, which are having some of the greatest impact. I think hopefully this is all just going to be a shock to our system, and we're going to wake up one morning and think, do you know what? We need to fix these processes because they're not working. We need the right people doing the right job in the right way. And they're out there, you know. I meet them. You've met them. There are some brilliant minds out there, but they're not the minds that are being used to make the decisions. That's the problem at the moment, you know.
Well, let's hope that some better decisions are going to be taken and sometime very soon. And I absolutely agree with you that care for wildlife, care for farm animals, care for our future, essentially, as people, should be left, right and centre of politics. It should be something which is shot through and is a given rather than a political football. Thank you very much for joining me today for this conversation. And let's get out there and motivate more people to join the dots, to see what their food actually means for the countryside and for animals and for the future of their children.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you go into a shop, I think the labelling, see, the first, you know, king for the day again, like I'll be king for the day again. First thing I do is I change the labelling of food. You know, if you buy cigarettes, which I don't, I think for a period of time, whether they still do it or not, I don't know, there were photographs on the packets of human organs which had been negatively impacted by smoking. Well, I think maybe we should have photographs of the, you know, conditions that the animals are kept in on the food when you're buying it. And that would change people's shopping practices like instantaneously, absolutely instantaneously. And that would be a really easy thing to do. I think that, you know, visits to local farms should be mandatory. I think everyone should go onto a farm, meet the farmers, you know, see what they do well, see what they don't do well, see the struggles that they face. Most British farmers are having a really tough time, certainly small farmers. Understand that, you know, I think I don't know, it's that fundamental contact that we need to rebuild, and then I think we'll make some progress, you know. And, you know, like Gandhi said, the health of a nation is measured by the way that it treats its animals. And at the moment, we can't say that the UK, therefore, is a particularly healthy nation.
Chris Packham, king for a day, if only. Thank you so much.
I don't want the crown. And I certainly don't want the ermine around the neck.
Thank you so much. Thank you.